Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne on why he sees President Trump's election as a call to fix American democracy as a whole.
We never had a president who daily raises such profound questions about his basic competence, his psychological capacity to take on the job. I don't think we've ever had a president who voiced prejudice so openly.
Also today, the NRA reported $337 million in revenue in 2015. Where does all that money come from? Plus, superbugs and big poultry, the rise of antibiotic resistance and disease through livestock.
One pretty good estimate now is that of those 6 to 8 million UTIs that occur in women every year in the United States, possibly 10% could be foodborne.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Happy Election Day, everyone. There are key elections going on in many communities, the mayoral race in Boston, for example, or Framingham voters creating a city government today, electing a mayor and city council for the first time, just to name a few. Plus, it was almost a year ago that President Donald Trump won the White House with a majority of the Electoral College and a minority of the popular vote. So we wanted to take a moment to examine that a little more closely, because Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne's new book starts with this pointed sentence. He says, quote, "American democracy was never supposed to give the nation a president like Donald Trump. And yet it did. How? Why? And for those who believe that the forces that gave rise to a Trump presidency are also eroding American democracy, the biggest question may be what to do about it. Well, Dionne's new book, co-authored with Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann, is called One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. And E.J. Dionne joins us in the studio now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Also with us today is Heather Cox Richardson. She's a professor of history at Boston College and author of To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. Plus, she's co-host of the WBUR podcast Freak Out and Carry On. Professor Richardson, it is good to see you again.
It's always a pleasure, Meghna.
And thank you for...
And can I say it's great to be with Professor Richardson, whom I've admired for a long time.
She's gonna lend some intellectual heft where I fall short here. But E.J., I wanted to start with a very simple question, just get right to a certain point that may speak really to how broken our politics is right now. And that is, you know, for a lot of listeners who hear the title of your book and then hear that I'm talking to E.J. Dionne, Washington Post columnist, what reason is there to believe, for them to believe, that this is anything other than a Democrat's lament to still disillusion Democrats? I mean, it just sounds like this is sort of an introspective kind of book and conversation, given the title, One Nation After Trump. Or do you have a bigger message here?
Well, I think the title actually reflects a belief on the part of all three of us that there can be one nation after Trump, that this is not the end of the story, that there are reasons this happened, and that there are ways in which we can overcome what we believe was a genuine catastrophe that befell the nation.
Can I just jump in here for a second, EJ? Because I want to say you said all three of us, but I actually believe there is one nation now. So, and then
when I said all three of us, I'm sorry, I was talking about the authors of the book.
Okay, Norman Thomas. Okay,
yeah, no, good. I believe there is one nation now, but I believe that we can create a sense of that one nation after a period of extraordinary division and fracturing. And indeed, as we say in the book, we quite consciously had the words of the Pledge of Allegiance in our heads. People forget, by the way, the pledge was written by a socialist. The pledge is actually a very progressive, forward-looking statement, and it ends with one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Under God was added, by the way, in the 1950s. And we don't pretend to speak for the Almighty, But with liberty and justice for all is what America is supposed to be about. And that cause suffered a real setback in this last election. So, but we think of it as a hopeful book for a couple of reasons. One is we go on at some length about the reaction to this election. Mm-hmm. There really is an extraordinary amount of organizing going on. There were spontaneous and then increasingly well-organized responses from civil society to everything from Trump's travel ban to the proposal to repeal Obamacare. We forget how extraordinary it was that everybody going into the year said Republican president, Republican Congress, Obamacare is dead. It isn't dead. Trump is trying to kill it in other ways, but it isn't dead because people showed up at these congressional offices. The country reflected on what repeal would mean, and a lot of people changed their mind on Obamacare. Yeah. So the book is very critical of Trump. We point out the ways in which we see him as having a lot of autocratic tendencies that are quite dangerous to democracy itself. But it's also forward-looking and hopeful, and it's based on our belief we will overcome this.
Well, so I do want to spend some time sort of talking about the forward-looking portion of the book, but let's spend a minute or two here talking about your analysis about how and why America arrived at a Trump presidency. And actually, Heather, I want to pull you in here because, again, I'm just taken by the first sentence in EJ's book that American democracy was never supposed to give the nation a president like Donald Trump, because I still, at the risk of repeating myself, I still think there are 60 million voters out there who would disagree with that and say, actually, yes, American democracy, the way it's built, the way it's set up, is exactly what allowed a person like Donald Trump to become president. And they don't have a problem with that.
There might be people who say that, but I'm with EJ on this one. I think he's right on, and this book is right on, the idea that the system was never set up to put in place somebody who doesn't believe in the system. And that's what we've got now, is a president and an administration and members of a political party who actually are looking actively to dismantle the government. And that is something that has developed over the last generation, the idea that somehow our government is the problem rather than the solution. And that's not to say it shouldn't be trimmed or we shouldn't make it do different things, but rather that we have, until recently, always had in charge of the government people who wanted to make it succeed rather than wanted to destroy it.
Hmm. The other thing that I think always needs to be pointed out is we have developed into a non-majoritarian democracy, which is an oxymoron, really, and that the fact that Hillary Clinton got 2.9 million more votes than Trump matters. The fact that this is the second election in just since 2000 in which the Electoral College was out of sync with the popular vote tells us how antiquated these institutions are, that an Electoral College does not reflect the movement of people in the country to large metropolitan areas. It doesn't reflect the diversity of the country. Mm. So we think we're in for some problems ahead if we don't think about how to fix this system. Same is true of the Senate. It's gerrymandering contributes to this, and a campaign money system that gives excessive power to a very small number of people.
You talk about how you take an extreme example in the book and how currently a voter in Wyoming has 3.5 times the electoral power as a California voter because of the way the system's set up.
Right. And that thank you for that. And if you look at the founding, the ratio between the smallest and largest state was 13-1. Now it's about 70-1 and rising. That creates a problem also for the United States Senate in the long run. And the Constitution makes it very hard to change representation in the Senate. But by 2040, 70% of Americans will live in 15 states. That means 70% of us will be represented by 30 senators. So I think that's a piece of the puzzle here. But the other piece we can't deny is the country has gone through a very difficult period in the last 15 years and in the last 30 years, that income inequality has been rising since, depending on where you want to date it, the mid-70s or 1980. It really started going haywire in the after 2000. That's a big problem. We went through a long period of inconclusive wars where the country looked at its leadership and said, how did we get involved in these sorts of things. So there was a lot of fed upness in the country, and Trump took advantage of that fed upness.
Right.
And he said, I'm going to drain the swamp, although, in fact, he's doing more to pollute the swamp than to drain
it. You describe the Trump presidency in the book as sort of more of a symptom of deeper woes rather than the illness itself. But I don't want to leave the Electoral College here just for a second, because two questions about that. One is, you talked about antiquated systems. I mean, the antiquated system we're talking about is built into the Constitution of the United States,
correct,
right? And so, I mean, in that case, an alternative take would be that while you see it as a bias against the majority, the founders saw it as protecting against the tyranny of the majority. And, I mean, does that not still does that viewpoint still not have any relevance? Heather, maybe I'll throw this to you. In 2017 America.
So I am with EJ and Spirit on this one, but there are some differences here in that it is in the Constitution, the Electoral College is in the Constitution, and what that means is that technically we don't elect our presidents, we elect electors, mm-hmm, who then elect our presidents. And each state has a number of votes in the Electoral College equal to their representation in the House and in the Senate. And that's a problem because we have limited the number of seats in the House of Representatives. What that means is that extraordinarily large states like California or New York don't actually have the accurate representation in the Electoral College they should. That's an issue, and that we should unpack a little bit. But what EJ started out by identifying seems to me to be the crucial issue right now, and that is that four times in our history we have had a president installed who lost the majority vote. It happened twice in the 19th century, and it's happened twice in the last in our lifetimes. And that suggests every time that happens, what you have is the threat of an illegitimate government, a government that the majority of people say, hey, it's not my government. It's not democracy. This is not what I voted for. And that is a crisis that should strike fear into the heart of every single American. We must find a way around that.
Just a quick point.
The system we have now in no way resembles what the founders had in mind anyway, because the founders didn't conceive that we would elect electors with popular votes. So the Electoral College was supposed to be a deliberative body. It's not a deliberative body. So we have this hybrid system that we created willy-nilly over a period of 100 years. It's not what the founders particularly wanted, and it's not functional now.
Well, so what happens is after the 1804 election, that states realize when the Electoral College creates a complete mess and it gets thrown in the House of Representatives, states stop making a deliberative body and they throw all their votes. They group winner takes all votes in most of the states. The other thing that's changed with the Electoral College is the addition of so many new states, including the six we got from 1889 to 1890, Wyoming, Idaho, North Dakota, South Dakota, that were deliberately put there to game the electoral system. Mm. So yes, it's not the same as it's always been. Montana's also in that one. It's not the same as it's always been, but it would be very hard to go back and say, let's rip this sucker out altogether. And how to fix that is, it seems to me, very much on the table. There's a lot of people with a lot of different suggestions, and so far I'm not seeing one that jumps out that says, oh yeah, this is obvious.
So I'm sorry to take this back to politics specifically, but EJ, forgive me, because I have to ask, I can't help this. Would you be saying the same things if Hillary Clinton had won the election, but with a minority of the popular vote?
I'd like to think so. I mean, I think there is a problem with, I mean, I think there's writing by me all the way back to 2000 saying that there would be a problem if 2000 had gone the other way and if Bush had won the popular vote and Gore had won the Electoral College. So I think there is a principal problem there. Obviously, I'll confess, it's easier for me to say this because Donald Trump is the beneficiary. There's no question about that. But I think there's something fundamentally wrong with a country that claims to be a democratic republic that has an undemocratic outcome of this sort. And Heather is absolutely right about this legitimacy problem. And because we've had it twice in just a few elections, if we keep doing this, then all the claims we make about ourselves as a great model democracy just will not be borne out, which is why, I mean, I think the best scheme on the table, and it's imperfect, is this national popular vote movement where enough states commit themselves to direct their electors to the winner of the popular vote, that you would de facto change the system. That's a long way from happening right now.
Right. But I was just going to ask you that, like sort of a reality check here.
Maybe there are about 160 electoral votes. I've forgotten the exact number. We have it in the book. There are states that have started doing this. The state that I vote in, Maryland, is part of that compact.
Right. But, Heather, your thoughts, because it just seems like it aspirational is the best way for me to put it in terms of making actual changes to the electoral process for the presidency.
It's not where I would start. I would start by getting voters to the polls, by insisting, by stopping voter suppression and making sure that everybody has an ID, a national ID. And I actually think that this is something that everybody can get behind. And I know there are objections to it both on the left and the right, but that everybody has a national ID that must be taken at the polls. And another suggestion that was in EJ's book, that you have to have a guarantee that you can vote within a half an hour of the time you get to a poll. Because the suppression of the vote is very easy to do by things like not putting in enough voting machines or making voting machines that are broken or break easily. If we fixed that, the rest of it, it seems to me, would fall into place much more easily. The gerrymandering, the problems with the Electoral College, because you put the voters back in place, the Electoral College starts to go the right way.
And I think that adding to that list is universal voter registration, where it should be automatic that you get registered to vote. We have a controversial idea that we know is not going to happen down the road, but we talk about compulsory voting, or as we prefer to call it, compulsory attendance at the polls, or universal voting. You can draw a Mickey Mouse on your ballot if you want. Australia has a system. It's worked very well for many years. The fine is very small. What I like about it is that it changes the obligations of local governments. They can't suppress the vote anymore. Their obligation is to make it as easy as possible for you to fulfill your civic obligation that you are now bound by law to live up to. And we took the secret ballot from Australia, so why not this one?
So we've spent quite a bit of time talking about the mechanics of voting, which is important, right? And it's going to continue to be an important issue. But EJ, in the book, you write quite deeply, you and your co-authors, about kind of more profound economic and social challenges in the United States that have led us to this moment, right? And basically, you call for sort of in fixing America's broken democracy, you call for a new economy, a new patriotism, a new civil society, and a new democracy. It sounds like rebuilding the country from the ground up, practically.
Well, given the wreckage right now, I think we do need quite a fundamental look at what's wrong, at what led us to a president who should not be there. So the new democracy part I won't talk about, because we talked about a number of pieces that we have in that new democracy section, a lot on voting and the right to vote and a new Voting Rights Act and fixes to the electoral system and ending gerrymandering, which Supreme Court might help us on soon, if Justice Kennedy decides to. So I'll leave that aside. For a new economy, we have a broad kind of egalitarian program that, and we point out that there are a lot of ideas that are already out there that need to be organized in a way that are compelling to people. We talk about Senator Warren has a whole series of ideas about how to give people rights in the gig economy. Senator Sherrod Brown introduced a great workers' bill of rights. Senator Gillibrand introduced a great kind of pro-family set and pro-women set of changes that would be particularly beneficial to women in the workforce, having to do with both pay and family leave, but also beneficial to everybody. But we need to recognize, I think, with the problem with, and I'm not one of those who's a Hillary basher, and I actually think she's a very impressive person. But the problem with that campaign, I think, is they didn't fully grasp how much they had to break through on economics. She had a lot of things in her economic program that were quite compelling. They didn't advertise on it. Trump advertised far more on the economy than Hillary Clinton did. And they can complain quite rightly that the press paid more attention to empty podiums at Trump rallies, waiting the television media to empty podiums waiting for Trump to show up than a Hillary Clinton economic speech. But the job of a campaign is to get your message through. And I don't think they got that through. And then we can talk about a new patriotism and a new civil society later.
But the new economy part, there are parts of the book when I was reading sort of your suggestions that made me wonder if you're sort of edging into Bernie Sanders territory here. Because let me just ask you flat out. I mean, is unfettered capitalism part of the problem here? And if so, don't Democrats, shouldn't they be looking in the mirror to in terms of the policies that they brought about in the 90s that helped us get to this point?
Well, we talked some about that, and I've talked about some of that in the past, some of the deregulation of Wall Street. Even Bill Clinton now thinks he made some mistakes in that sphere. But we talk about a broad center left, and that you can't win without Bernie Sanders and his people, and you can't win an election. You can't elect a progressive without more moderate voters. And unfettered is the key. A market system can work very well. An unfettered market system has never worked well. The reason we have regulation is, among other things, because we had a Great Depression and then we had this Great Recession. The reason we have a social safety net is that capitalism all by itself is not going to operate successfully. So that, I've always said that the people who end up saving capitalism every time are capitalism's critics, because they are the people who know that this system all by itself isn't going to work.
I want to get Heather's thought on this.
Well, so I think when you look at the proposals that people like E.G. Dionne are putting out there, or you look at where we are in the country, or even if you look at the people who voted for Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, and the idea that you suggested earlier, the idea that he shouldn't be president, a lot of people voted for him because they wanted to wreck the system the way it was.
Exactly.
And it seems to me fundamentally what we are looking at is a question of, for whom should our government work? Should it work for the people at the bottom who are working hard and trying to make it and trying to feed their kids and trying to do things work from the bottom up or from the top down? And what we have right now and have had since 1980 is an ideology that says the system works best if it works from the top down, and you slash everything so that the people at the top who really know what they're doing better than anybody else can have free rein to do whatever they want. And this is a moment, Donald Trump's election seemed to me to be a moment, almost a snapshot, where people said, wait a minute. You've been telling us for a generation that this is going to work, and we've moved backward. 99% of us are in much worse shape, and we don't like it. So what are we going to do? And they threw that into chaos, and the government into chaos, and the country into chaos, in all sorts of ugly ways as well as productive ways. But this is the moment where people say, we need to take our government back. And when that happens, when America does that, change happens fast. So, EJ's book looks like a grab bag in a lot of ways. And that's one of the things I find very frustrating about this moment, is everyone's got that one magic thing, or the string bag full of all these different things that you could put in it. But when these moments happen, when Americans say, no, that's not the government we want, change is often extraordinarily rapid. FDR's first 100 days, Abraham Lincoln's first 3 months. You know, when things change in America, they often change on a dime.
Yeah.
It's a happy grab bag. Can I plug Heather's last book, or I think it was your last book, on the Republican Party? Because this notion of unfettered capitalism and needing ideas to counter the market, as Heather points out in that book, Abraham Lincoln, besides using federal power to end slavery, that was a period that gave us the land-grant colleges, which have done enormous amounts of good over a very long period of time. It's a period that gave us the Homestead Act, which created a whole new set of landowners, small landowners in the country. Teddy Roosevelt, by the way, was for campaign finance reform, among other things.
And health care.
And health care. And then Dwight Eisenhower, interstate highways and the federal student loan program started under Dwight Eisenhower. There was once a Republican Party that was willing to acknowledge that using government to improve the lives of people and to invest in the country's future was a useful thing to do.
We need to reclaim that. I actually think that perhaps I would say that both parties need to reclaim that, because, yes, Hillary Clinton won the majority of the popular vote. I get it. But I think for all those people who were once Obama voters but then voted for Trump, they were saying, we don't see a Democratic Party necessarily that recognizes our needs so much anymore. I just got a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask both of you one thing, because, yeah, there are lots of ideas in your book, EJ, and I think taken individually, they all seem to make a lot of sense. But there's one line that you have actually comes early in the book where you say that to see Trumpism, to see where Trumpism comes from is to understand that this worldview, as we've been discussing, didn't just suddenly sweep the nation. It's been 40 years in the making. But then you go on, you say, and it does not represent an irresistible wave of the future. Now, I wonder why you're so confident about that, because the very same forces that got us here, to me, the remedies that you suggest in the book require those forces to consciously let go of the power they've accumulated in the past couple of generations. And that seems to be an enormous challenge right now.
Trumpism is not the wave of the future demographically, first of all. If you look at the country that will exist in 10 or 20 years, it's going to be a different country. Young people are progressive. Trump gained nothing among young people. Hillary lost some votes to third party voting. The country will be more diverse, more Latino, more African-American, more Asian. Trumpism does not represent that wave at all. So that's one reason why it doesn't represent the wave of the future. The other is Trumpism doesn't represent the interests of the very working class that he claimed to talk about. And this new tax bill is exhibit number one. It's the oligarchy tax cut of 2017. And I think that Trump's working class supporters are not indifferent to their own circumstance. And they're not going to look at this and say, gee, that's really good for us. They know it's not.
Yeah. Heather, last quick thought.
I think you either believe in human self-determination in America and in American democracy, or you don't. And I happen to believe in it.
Well,
amen.
E.J. Dionne's new book is One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. And Heather Cox Richardson, who is also with us today, she's a history professor at Boston College. And by the way, Heather will be moderating a panel discussion with E.J. and one of his co-authors, Norman Ornstein, at the Edward Kennedy Institute for the U.S. Senate tomorrow night. We've got information about that at radioboston.org. Thank you so much, both of you, for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A bit earlier today, the National Rifle Association, through its own media group, NRA TV, aired an extended interview with Stephen Williford. He's the Sutherland Springs, Texas resident who picked up his rifle and exchanged fire with Devin Kelly. Kelly's the church shooter who killed 26 people on Sunday.
I kept hearing those shots, and I knew every shot might be representing another person getting hit by a bullet. And I didn't take time to put shoes on even. I ran out of the door.
NRA TV describes Williford as an NRA member and hero. Well, that makes him one of the 5 million dues-paying Americans who are members of the NRA. And those numbers, plus the existence of things like NRA TV, show the reach and influence the group has. Now, another measure of that influence, it's money. But where that money comes from may surprise you. Boston Globe columnist Evan Horowitz has dug into the NRA's funding sources, and he joins us now. Evan, it's good to see you.
Great to be here, Meghna.
Okay, so first of all, let's just get the basics. How much money does the NRA have?
A lot. A lot is the short answer. In 2015, they raised, in just annual revenue, over $300
million. $337 million. I get a cheat sheet here.
No, that's so good. It's a lot of money for an organization that doesn't sell anything, right? They're not getting revenue because they're selling teddy bears or weapons or anything like that.
They're an advocacy organization.
And a membership organization.
So then how much of that money comes from those 5 million dues-paying members?
Most of it.
Okay.
So, you know, people... You hear the accusation that they're a lobbying group for the gun industry, that they represent gun manufacturers. The bulk of their revenue comes from dues-paying members and their programs. So that is people who really want an NRA membership card, people who want to get one of the magazines, people who attend maybe the gun training class, or they have social events. And that's, you know, in little batches, $40 from this person, $50 from that person, $25 from that person, adds up to about $180 million in total, the bulk of their funding.
Okay, so but then, as you said, we frequently hear from critics of the NRA that the NRA is taking money from special interests, from gun manufacturers, that et cetera. I mean, so how much of the money comes from, quote unquote, gun manufacturers?
So some of it does, right? Yeah. There is also money coming from major figures in the gun world. That is, the president of Beretta is one of the well-known Ring of Freedom highest-level donors. So is the CEO of Smith & Wesson. These people are contributing large amounts of money to the NRA as an organization. But their contributions are dwarfed by the small contributions of members.
Okay. So this is really interesting then because, again, as I said a second ago, the NRA, lots of critics heap criticism on the NRA for the amount of money that it has and how it's spending it and where they say it's coming from. But given what you just said about this combination of the majority coming from dues-paying members and then a not insignificant portion coming from manufacturers, I guess what I'm wondering is how different is that from other large moneyed advocacy organizations in the country?
It's pretty different. I mean, okay, so there are think of a couple of others. Let's go through a couple. Say like the National Association of Realtors or something. This is a big lobbying group, right? But they have dues-paying members, but the members are realtors or real estate organizations. It's a professional organization. That's not what the NRA is like. The NRA is not a group of professionals. It's a citizen-based organization, people who care about the issue. There are some close correlations. The AARP, maybe. They're just individuals, but it's not a single issue. Right. Lobbying group. The one that came to mind, AAA. People don't know this, but AAA, you know, if you get it for your roadside assistance and things, they're actually a major lobbying group, and they lobby on your behalf for road building, road construction and stuff. People don't realize it, but that's one where they get a lot of dues from individuals. But the contrast would be with, like, the cigarette industry. Mm-hmm. So the NRA gets most of their money from individuals who want to be members, people who really want that card. The cigarette industry had a very powerful lobby. It was not funded by individual cigarette smokers who believed in the cause, right? It was funded by major cigarette manufacturers. That's quite different than how the NRA operates.
You know, you also have reported on how the NRA, let's give them credit, are quite creative in how they raise some of this money. I didn't know about this thing called the Roundup, that when a gun owner wants to purchase a new firearm, that through that purchase they can also help fund the NRA?
Yeah, so it's actually, if you are a store that sells guns and you want to participate in this program, then you can do that. And you say, oh, this, or maybe the ammunition, right? These bullets, they cost $19.12. Do you want to round it up to $20 and give the extra 88 cents to not just the NRA, but a specific arm of the NRA, their lobbying arm?
Uh-huh.
And people say yes, and this generates a lot of money for the NRA lobbying arm.
Okay, so then that leads me to the next obvious question, which is how much money did the NRA or has the NRA spent on its lobbying?
So the NRA spends a lot of money on lobbying. Some of it easy to track, some of it harder to track. In the 2016 cycle, they spent roughly $60 million. Now, that's both the NRA major organization. Well, I shouldn't say both. That includes the NRA major organization, the NRA lobbying group, and also the PAC. They have a PAC, which is separate. I'm happy to talk about the relationship between these things. But they use them very differently, these various sub-organizations. They raise money differently. They have different rules about how they spend money. And the NRA is very creative about how it funnels money to these organizations and how it makes up the $60 million in contributions.
Are they getting their money's worth?
So insofar as we have had a number of mass shootings and very little movement towards gun control, I think it's hard to argue that they're not getting their money's worth. But I think they could say they expected more. They endorsed President Trump. They expected great things, I think, in terms of further loosening or further extension of gun rights or further loosening of gun control. So major priorities include things like federal reciprocity law. So if you have a permit to carry a gun in one state, that permit should apply to all states. Right? Mm-hmm. The federal government may be able to pass a law like that, and people who have the license to carry in Texas could come to Massachusetts and be allowed to carry, even though we do not have such a stipulation here. So that's something they've wanted and haven't been able to get. But I don't know if they can reasonably get it because we have the filibuster, and those kinds of issues seem to me non-compromisable issues, is that a word? Issues on which the Democrats will not compromise. So I don't see how you get that through a filibuster.
Interesting. So Evan, I want to switch gears here for a second. And that's a thank you for your comprehensive overview of where the RNRA gets its money. No, I mean, it's important to understand for any special interest group, honestly, how and where and when and by what means they get their money. And because I want to switch gears here for a second to the tax plan that's working its way through Congress. But before I do that, I just want to give folks a little update on Texas, because we had some news this afternoon that Devin Kelly, the suspect, the shooter in the church in the Sutherland, I mean, in the church shooting in Texas, there's some news here that he had escaped from a psychiatric hospital back in 2012. He was in a psychiatric hospital in New Mexico. That was at the time he was at the Air Force. And a police report that was reported on today by a Texas news organization said that Kelly had tried to sneak firearms onto an Air Force base and had made death threats against his superiors in the military. This was all obtained by Houston television station KPRC. They said he was in the hospital after he was charged with assault on his wife and stepson in military court. And he had escaped from that hospital again in 2012 and crossed state lines back into Texas and arrested in El Paso. So still lots more questions about how he was able to get his firearms, even after having been in a mental hospital, mental health institution in New Mexico. So just that little update there from Texas. But again, just quickly turning back, if we can, Evan, to the tax plan working its way through Congress. You've been looking at how the plan could affect Massachusetts residents. You want to give me sort of the nutshell of what you found?
In surprising ways. I mean, the headline is not surprising. We know this plan favors the wealthiest, the highest earning Americans over average Americans. I mean, if you earn in Massachusetts $800,000 or above, if you fit that in the top 1%, you get an average tax break in the first year of $75,000. Whereas if you're in the middle of the income ladder, you get $1,100. So, I mean, that headline is not surprising. We've known for a long time since Donald Trump started talking about this plan that ultimately that's what the plan would look like. Mm-hmm. What is surprising is that lots of top earners would actually see tax increases. The ITEP, who ran the analysis on the state-by-state analysis, found that 40% of the top 1% and 40% pretty much of everybody from the upper middle class through to the very wealthy in Massachusetts would see tax increases rather than tax cuts. That's really surprising, and I don't think that was ever part of the Republican plan.
Just give me some sort of absolute values here in terms of numbers. When we say 40% of the top 1%, these are earners over
$800,000. Well, it's households.
40% of those people?
Yeah, 40% of those people, but also 40% of people. Think of it more broadly. It's like something like 35 to 40% of everybody earning more than $100,000. Is likely to see a tax increase by 2027. And that's definitely not part of the plan. And it has to do with a number of factors. One is the plan isn't really a tax cut for the wealthy. It's a tax cut for wealthy business owners, mm-hmm. right? So if you are an executive but you get paid a salary, there's not much in this plan for you and a lot of reasons to think your taxes will go up over time. But if you are not an executive who earns a salary but you have lots of stock or you run your own business, then you get big breaks. The other thing for the upper middle class is, well, they're going to cap a lot of valuable deductions that people rely on, like the mortgage interest deduction. And those caps actually get tighter every year because they're not set up to adjust for inflation.
Exactly. So this may be one of the reasons why today we're seeing folks like Ted Cruz saying he may no longer be able to support the plans as it currently stands. But Evan Horowitz, quick study columnist at the Boston Globe, it is always a pleasure to take a trip through the numbers with you, Evan. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure to guide you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And if you're planning on poultry for dinner tonight, I would never actually recommend that you turn off Radio Boston, but it might actually be time to do that because we've got a scary story for you. We're about to take a closer look at America's favorite meat and the role that chicken has played when it comes to antibiotic resistance. And that's the rise of strains of bacteria that can't be treated by common antibiotics. Our next guest calls it the greatest slow-brewing health crisis of our time. Journalist Maren McKenna dives deep into the connection between livestock and the millions of pounds of antibiotics we feed them every year in her new book, Big Chicken. And she joins us from WABE in Atlanta. Maren, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hello.
So first of all, can you give us some context to understand the scope of the concern that you have here? Because I've seen, you know, according to some, that in terms of all the antibiotics used, 80% of that goes to veterinary or livestock. But what fraction of that goes to chicken? I mean, how much antibiotics does the poultry industry use?
At the moment, we don't actually know.
Oh.
Because in the data that's tendered to the FDA every year by the makers of veterinary antibiotics, there has been no requirement to break it out by species. That will actually happen for the first time in the data that we ought to get by the end of this year. But what we do know is that chicken is the most consumed meat in the United States and growing in popularity around the world. It will be the most common meat eaten in the world soon. And since the very beginning of the antibiotic era and the beginning of the industrialization of poultry, antibiotics have played a key role in making poultry and other livestock as well, rapidly produced and cheap.
Right. I mean, in the book, you write about how antibiotics have been so difficult to root out of modern meat because, in a way, they created it. What do you mean by that?
So we use antibiotics in livestock, all kinds of meat animals, for a couple of different reasons. We use them to treat diseases. Of course, no one argues with that, not even me. We use them to make animals grow faster, to put on weight faster. And we use them to protect against the diseases that they get from being crowded together in barns and feedlots. And all of those uses go back to the very beginning of the antibiotic era. They have existed for decades. Being able to grow animals more quickly caused us to sort of start thinking of them more like widgets than like animals, to turn them from chickens into the single thing of chicken. And then once we started thinking about moving them through the process more rapidly, farms started to get bigger, and antibiotics made it possible for farms to get bigger yet. So antibiotics really underpin the entire system of producing livestock.
Right. Well, I wonder if you could tell us the story of one particular antibiotic, specifically as a way to help us understand the scope here, because you write about oreomycin. Give us some background on that antibiotic.
So oreomycin, which the trade name for which is chlortetracycline, is one of the first drugs that starts the antibiotic era. Penicillin comes out in about 1943 onto the open market, and oreomycin is licensed in 1948. Oreomycin is a drug for people, as all the first antibiotics are, but one of the chemists that works at the company that makes oreomycin, a man named Thomas Jukes, has the idea to test whether tiny doses of oreomycin can be used as a feed supplement. It's the end of World War II. The food system is very fragile. They're looking to take expenses out of producing meat. And so he conducts an experiment in which he gives chickens are essential to this story, different supplements, and the ones that get oreomycin grow the fastest. So oreomycin turns out to be the drug that teaches agriculture how to misuse antibiotics, first in chicken, and then chicken really teaches the rest of agriculture how to do it too.
Wow. Now, you also talk about how, for all the reasons what you just said, like you can grow the chickens faster, they can put on more weight, you reduce the amount of disease in the livestock, et cetera. These are all seem to be straightforward reasons why farmers and the industry would want to use it. But you also, in the book, talk about how maybe it seems so far away from where we are now as a society, but that in the 50s, consumers may have demanded this too.
It's true. So I think it's important in understanding this history to think that everyone, or just about everyone who takes part in it, had good intentions at the time. Adding antibiotics to animal feed at the end of World War II was a good idea because it made protein safer and more cheap. Then adding antibiotics in the way that you're talking about, adding antibiotics to essentially dead animals, to animals that had been butchered, made them able to stay in butchers' cold cases longer. And there was a time when consumers thought this was a very positive thing. This was better living through chemistry. This was being sort of fashionable and sciencey and facing toward the future. And it wasn't until first people got to be suspicious of food supplements generally, food additives in the late 1960s. And second, that the first outbreaks, epidemics really, of antibiotic-resistant foodborne illness, a thing that had never before existed in the world, started to be perceived by epidemiology, that social pressure really began to turn against this use.
Interesting. Well, so I'm going to circle back here to something you said a little earlier. And sorry for bouncing all over the place here, because this is such a – but it's such a – you go so deep into your research of the history and where we also find ourselves in terms of antibiotic resistance. But you did – in the book, you write about visiting a farm with someone named Will Harris, who tells you that, you know, in this process of – industrial poultry farming, that he says they just bred all the chicken out of the chicken. What did he mean by that?
So Will Harris is a fantastic person. He is the proprietor, the fourth generation to run a multi-species pasture-based farm in South Georgia, a farm that began as a subsistence farm and then, as many, many livestock farms did in America in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, became a fully industrial, very sciencey, entirely relying on antibiotics and hormones cattle farm. And then he had a kind of realization that this was not the way he wanted to live the rest of his life. And he took all the hormones and antibiotics out of the system, all of the artificial feed. He turned his cattle onto grass. He brought in many other species to do a kind of rotational grazing. And chickens are a really important part of his process. Mm. And the chickens on his farm, which are like chickens in other parts of the world, as well as in other pasture-based farms in the United States, are chickens that are very different, just even physically, from the chickens that come out of very large industrial-scale farms. These chickens have colored feathers. They are more upright. They can fly. They feed themselves. They scratch around. They move around fields. And the chickens that are in the very large barns that until very recently have depended very much on antibiotics are they're white and they're docile and they tend not to fly anywhere. They mostly sit in one place and they get up and they feed themselves and they drink some water and they get back down. And they were designed that way by successive breeding by the poultry industry starting in the 1950s to be a chicken that would be more meaty, that would have the kinds of white meat that we like to eat in America, that would be docile because you need a docile animal if it's going to agree to be confined in that manner, and that would also grow very, very quickly. The average age at slaughter of an American chicken raised in that manner, a conventional chicken, is about 42 days.
Wow. Wow. How long have we known that some antibiotic resistance may be emerging from the heavy use of antibiotics in the poultry industry?
A shockingly long time. This is one of the things that was most amazing to me in excavating this history is that I think people have some sense that the discussion about antibiotic use in the production of meat is something that's been happening just in the past couple of years. And maybe people who've been in public health for a while might realize that we tried to ban this and failed in the United States in the 1970s. But in fact, the first objections to it, the first warnings that this might give rise to antibiotic-resistant bacteria moving off farms either in meat or in manure from the animals that then washes through the environment. Those warnings go back to the very first experiments, to the late 1940s and early 1950s. And that realization prompted other governments in England, in Scandinavia, in the European Union to put curbs on farm antibiotic use from as far back as the 1960s to, in the case of the European Union, 11 years ago.
Huh. Well, so specifically regarding American poultry farming, though, a cynical take would be that the genie's out of the bottle here. Like if we were to put restrictions on antibiotic use here or ban them entirely, for example, amongst poultry, I mean, wouldn't that call for a drastic change in farming practices? And is that how realistic is that?
So this is the argument that some people in the industry made for quite a long time, that for as good or bad as this is, we cannot now change. We can't make protein less cheap. We can't take antibiotics out of the system. Animals will get sick. It turns out that that's not true. And one of the things that was most encouraging to me in reporting this long story is that it was some poultry companies that led the way in proving that wasn't true. The company Purdue Farms, which is the fourth largest chicken company in America, in 2014 announced that they were on a journey to going antibiotic-free, and they are now effectively antibiotic-free. They use antibiotics in maybe 1% of their birds per year. They do things instead like giving them more space and allowing them to exercise and changing their diets and giving them herbal supplements. And they have managed to do that, to convert their company and not to go broke and not to lose customers. In fact, they did it because their customers were asking. So the contention that we have to use antibiotics because without them the system will collapse turns out not to be correct.
Well, you, in thinking about Purdue, you also write about how Chick-fil-A is moving towards breaking with the use of antibiotics. And I had forgotten about this, but McDonald's, what, in 2015, said it was going to go antibiotic-free for chicken in its North American restaurants. So we've just got less than a minute here. Are market forces taking care of this problem? I mean, perhaps the need for regulation isn't there.
Market forces have helped, and they helped because consumers pushed them to. But the reality is that regulations are necessary because unless you set regulations, everyone will sort of carve their own path, right? And in Europe, it was shown when they did their ban that it didn't work as well as they thought. In fact, just today, the World Health Organization urged governments all over the world to move toward very sharp cuts in antibiotic use in livestock, with the recognition that as much as markets and consumer pressure move us in the right direction, we really need some degree of rulemaking as well to make sure that we stay where we're going.
Well, Maren McKenna's new book is Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture and changed the way the world eats. It's a tremendous book. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you very much.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.